Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Ku Klux Klan, Part 2. My name is Jamie Black. I'm a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. During the last half of the 19th century, the distant memory of the Ku Klux Klan's brief grip on the South had faded, and its bloody deeds were largely forgotten by many white citizens. Citizens who once held sympathetic views with the Klan's cause and beliefs. On the national level, 2 events served to set the stage for the return of the Ku Klux Klan in the early part of the 20th century. The first was the massive immigration into the United States, bringing an estimated 23 million people into the country from Great Britain, Germany, Italy, Hungary, and Russia, amidst a great cry of opposition from some vocal Americans.
Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land. Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch whose flame is the imprisoned lightning and her name. Mother of exiles, from her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome, her mild eyes command. The air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
These are the words of American poet Emma Lazarus in her 1883 sonnet, The New Colossus. The American Protective Association, which had been organized in 1887, reflected that the attitude of many Americans at the time was that they believed that the nation was being swamped by alien people. This organization, a secret oath-bound group, was especially strong in the Midwest, where the reborn Ku Klux Klan would later draw much of its strength and support. The other major event, which prepared the ground for the Klan's return, was the First World War, which had a wrenching, unsettling effect on the nation. On the European battlefields, white Americans again were exposed to unrestrained bloodshed, while blacks served in the uniform of their country and saw open up before them a new world. Back at home, Americans learned suspicion, hatred, and distrust of anything alien, a sentiment which led to the rejection of President Woodrow Wilson's League of Nations. In the South, yet another series of events occurred, which helped breathe life into the Klan several decades later. In the 1890s, an agrarian populist movement tried to build a coalition of blacks and poor whites against the mill owners, large landholders, and conservative elites of the Old South. The aristocracy responded with the old cry of white supremacy and the manipulation of black votes. As a result, the populace was substantially turned back in every Deep South state except Georgia and North Carolina. A feeling spread across the South, shared by both the aristocracy and many poor white people, that blacks had to be frozen out of society. The 1890s marked the beginning of efforts in the Deep South to deny political, social, and economic power to black people. Most segregation and disenfranchisement laws date from that period. It was also the beginning of a series of lynchings of black by white mobs, and the combination of legalized racism and the constant threat of violence, which eventually led to a major black migration to northern cities. William J. Simmons, a Spanish War veteran turned preacher turned salesman, was a compulsive joiner who held memberships in a dozen different societies and two churches. But he had always dreamed of starting his own fraternal group, and in the autumn of 1915, he put his plans into action. On Thanksgiving Eve, Simmons herded 15 fellow fraternalists onto a hired bus and drove them from Atlanta to nearby Stone Mountain. There, before a cross of pine boards, Simmons lit a match, and the Ku Klux Klan of the 20th century was born. Although Simmons would adopt the titles and regalia of the original version, his new creation, at its outset, had little similarity to the Reconstruction Klan. It was, in fact, little different from any of the dozens of other benevolent societies that were then popular in America. There is little doubt that Simmons' ultimate purpose in forming the group was to make money. But growth at first was slow. Even after America entered the First World War in 1917, and the Klan had a real, quote-unquote, purpose. That of defending the country from aliens, idlers, and union leaders was at its forefront. Then, in 1920, Simmons met Edward Young Clark and Elizabeth Tyler, two publicists who had formed a business in Atlanta. In June of 1920, with the Klan's membership at only a few thousand, Simmons signed a contract with Clark and Mrs. Tyler, giving them 80% of the profits from the dues of the new members. These new promoters used an aggressive new sales pitch. The Klan would be rabidly pro-American, which to them meant rabidly anti-black, anti-Jewish, and most importantly, anti-Catholic. Simmons graphically illustrated the new approach when he was introduced to an audience of Georgia Klansmen and drew a Colt automatic pistol, a revolver and a cartridge belt from his coat and arranged them on the table before him. Plunging a Bowie knife into the table beside the guns, he issued an invitation.
"Now, let the Catholics, Jews, and all others who disdain my imperial wizardry come out."
This message was clear. The new Klan was serious. And that meant expanding its list of enemies to include Asians, immigrants, bootleggers, drugs, graft, nightclubs and roadhouses, violation of the Sabbath, sex, both pre- and extramarital escapades, and any scandalous behavior. The Klan, with its new mission of social vigilance, soon had organizers scouring the nation, probing for the fears of the communities that they hit, and then exploiting them to the hilt. And the tactic was immediately a raging success. By the late summer of 1921, nearly 100,000 had enrolled in the Invisible Empire, and at $10 a head, tax-free since the Klan was a quote-unquote benevolent society, the profits were impressive. While Simmons made speeches and tinkered with ritual, Clark busied himself with expanding the treasury, launching Klan publishing and manufacturing firms, and also investing in real estate. The future looked very good for the Klan. But during that summer, the KKK leaders in Atlanta ran into their first element of trouble, controlling their far-flung empire. While Klan officials talked of fraternal ideals in Atlanta, their members across the nation began to take seriously the fiery rhetoric the recruiters were using to drum up new initiation fees. Violence first flared in a rampage of whippings, tar and feathering raids, and the use of acid to brand the letters KKK on the foreheads of blacks, Jews, and others they considered anti-American. Ministers, sheriffs, policemen, mayors, and judges either ignored the violence or secretly participated. Few Klansmen were arrested, much less convicted. In September of 1921, the New York World began a series of articles about the KKK, backed up by the revelations of an ex-recruiter. Another newspaper reported some of the internal gossip and financial manipulations within the Atlanta headquarters. And even more embarrassing was a story in the World where Clark and Mrs. Tyler had been arrested, not quite fully clothed, in a police raid on a bawdy house in 1919. The article badly tarnished the Klan's moralistic image and precipitated a serious rift within the ranks. The New York World exposés also brought demands for countermeasures, and Congress responded in October 1921 with hearings into the Klan's activities. Although the congressional inquiry so upset Clark that he considered resigning, the actual hearings did little damage to the Klan's reputation. Simmons explained away the secrecy of the Klan as just part of the fraternal aspect of the organization. He disavowed any link between his Klan and the Knight Riders of Reconstruction days, and he denied, just as Forrest had done 50 years earlier, any knowledge or responsibility in regards to any violence. The committee adjourned without action, and the Klan, of course, benefited from all of the free publicity. It almost seemed as if people in the rural areas of the country were determined to support whatever the big newspapers and Congress condemned. Following more articles in the New York World in October, these concentrated on the violent nature of the Klan, membership in the Invisible Empire exploded.
It wasn't until the newspapers began to attack the Klan that it really grew. Certain newspapers also aided us by inducing Congress to investigate us. The result was that Congress gave us the best advertising we ever got. Congress made us.
These are Simmons' own words, which he would later recall. With the Klan's new strength came prolonged internal bickering. In the autumn of 1922, with Texas dentist Hiram Wesley Evans leading the way, six conspirators made plans to dethrone Simmons. Evans would become Imperial Wizard. And in 1923, the conspirators saw a chance to grab permanent control of the Klan's property, which was worth millions by this time. When Clark was indicted on a 2-year-old morals charge, Evans was able to cancel the promoter's lucrative contract with the Klan and thus seize control of the money-making dues apparatus. Mrs. Tyler had already resigned to get married, so that left only Simmons, who became furious when he realized he had been outmaneuvered by Evans and his faction. A full-scale war was fought between the Evans and Simmons factions, with lawsuits and countersuits, warrants and injunctions, all gleefully reported in newspapers across the country. The fight spilled over into chapters in Texas and Pennsylvania and resulted in the shooting of Simmons' lawyer by Evans' chief publicity man. The power struggle ended in February of 1924 when Simmons agreed to a cash settlement. The Klan continued to grow during this period of internal strife, but its weaknesses were laid open for America to see. The Klan promoted itself as an organization dedicated to defending the morals of the nation, but there had been far too many charges of immorality against its own leaders. Its supposed non-profit status was badly undermined by the wrangling over finances, and most of its vaunted secrecy was exposed in the reams of court documents churned out by the feuding. More than anything, though, it was its violence that was clearly revealed. Under Evans, the Klan launched a campaign of terrorism in the early and mid-1920s, and many communities found themselves firmly in the grasp of the organization. Lynchings, shootings, and whippings were the methods employed by the Klan at the time. Black citizens, Jews, Catholics, Mexicans, and various other immigrants were usually the victims. But not infrequently, the Klan's targets were also white people. Protestants and females who were considered immoral or traitors to their race or gender. In Alabama, for example, a divorcee with two children was flogged for the crime of remarrying and then given a jar of Vaseline for her wounds. In Georgia, a woman was given 60 lashings for a vague charge of immorality and failure to go to church. When her 15-year-old son ran to her rescue, he received the same treatment. In both cases, it was ministers who led the Klansmen responsible for the violence. But such instances were not confined to the Deep South. In Oklahoma, Klansmen gave lashings to girls who were caught riding in automobiles with young men. And very early in the Klan's revival, women were flogged and even tortured in the San Joaquin Valley of California. In a period when many women were fighting for the vote, for a place in the job market, and for personal and cultural freedom. The Klan claimed to stand for pure womanhood and frequently attacked women who sought independence. During the period of its most uncontrolled violence, the Klan also experienced unprecedented political gains. In 1922, Texas sent Klansman Earl Mayfield to the U.S. Senate, and Klan campaigns helped defeat two Jewish congressmen who had headed the Klan inquiry. Klan efforts were credited with helping to elect governors in 12 states by the early 1920s. By now, and with 2 million members and new recruits joining the secret ranks daily, a host of friendly politicians throughout the land and his internal enemies subdued for the moment, Evans wanted to influence the presidential election of 1924. He even shifted his national headquarters from Atlanta to Washington, D.C. The Klan had a foothold in both parties, since Deep South members tended to be Democrats, while Klansmen in the North and West were often Republicans. But of the three major presidential candidates, two were outspoken enemies of the Ku Klux Klan. And that year, when the Democratic Convention opened in New York, many Democrats were demanding the party adopt a platform condemning the KKK. The resulting fight tore the convention apart. After days of bitter wrangling over the issue, the platform denouncing the Klan lost by a single vote. Although politicians became increasingly uncomfortable with Klan allies as a result of the turmoil, the success of the Klan candidates across the nation in 1924 buoyed Evans' spirits. His notoriety peaked with a parade of 40,000 Klansmen down Washington's Pennsylvania Avenue to the Washington Monument in August of 1925. Evans boasted of having helped re-elect Coolidge, of having secured passage of strict anti-immigration laws, and of having checked the ambitions of Catholics and others intent on perverting, as he called it, the nation. The Klan was riding high. Hey guys, I'm just going to pause this episode here to invite you all, well, those who haven't already done so, to head over to our Patreon and sign on up. Our Patreon gives you access to extra episodes, articles, blogs, and research material, and all for just $2 a month. That's all for less than the price of a cup of coffee. That's a hell of a bargain, if I don't mind saying. If you're interested in joining us, head over to www.patreon.com/deadsouls. We can't wait to see you guys over there. For all of you who have already signed up, thank you so, so much. We are absolutely ingratiated to have you with us. And while you are there, reach out and say hello. Okay, back to the episode. By the mid-1920s, the decline of the Ku Klux Klan was already well underway. Because by 1926, when Evans tried to repeat the parade in Washington, only half as many members arrived to march, and they were sabred by the news of political defeats in areas that a year before had been considered safe Klan strongholds. Increasingly, the Klan suffered counterattacks by the clergy, the press, and a growing number of politicians. Then in 1927, a group of rebellious Klansmen in Pennsylvania broke away from the Invisible Empire, and Evans promptly filed a $100,000 damage suit against them, confident that he could make an example of the rebels. To his surprise, the Pennsylvania Klansmen fought back in the courts, and the resulting string of witnesses told of Klan horrors, terrorism, and violence, named members, and spilled secrets. Newspapers carried accounts of testimony ranging from the kidnapping of a small girl from her grandparents in Pittsburgh to a Colorado Klansman who was beaten when he tried to quit the group. One particularly horrible story described how a man in Terrell, Texas, had been soaked in oil and burned to death before several hundred Klansmen. The enraged judge threw Evans' case out of court. The following year, the Democrats nominated Al Smith, a New York Catholic and longtime Klan foe, for president against the Republicans Herbert Hoover. The Ku Klux Klan had a perfect issue which Evans hoped to use to whip up the faithful. But his invisible empire had melted from 3 million in 1925 to no more than several hundred thousand, and the Klan was no factor in Hoover's election. Americans had clearly tired of the divisive effect of the masks, robes, and burning crosses. What was left of the Klan's clout disappeared as its old friends in office, smelling the new political winds, deserted the organization in droves. During the 1930s, the nation struggled through the Great Depression, and the Klan continued to shrink in size. The Klan became primarily a fraternal society. Its leaders urged its members to stay out of trouble, and the national headquarters were hoarding its meager funds. After Franklin D. Roosevelt took office, the Klan began to charge that he was bringing too many Catholics and Jews into the government. Later, they added the charge that the New Deal was tinged with communism. The Red Menace was used more and more by Evans and other Klansmen as the rallying cry, and communists eventually replaced Catholics as one of the Klan's foremost enemies. Only in Florida was the Klan still a factor in the 1930s. With a membership of about 30,000, the Klan was active in Jacksonville, Miami, and the Citrus Belt from Orlando to Tampa. In the orange groves of central Florida, Klansmen still operated in the old night-riding style, intimidating blacks who tried to vote, punishing marital infidelity, and clashing with union organizers. Florida responded with laws to unmask the night riders, and a crusading journalist named Stetson Kennedy infiltrated and then exposed the Klan, rousing the anger of ministers, editors, politicians, and plain citizens. In 1939, Evans was replaced by James Ale Colescott of Indiana. He led the Klan in the Carolinas, where unions were trying to organize textile workers, and in Georgia, where night riders flogged some 50 people during a two-year period. An outcry from the citizens of Georgia and South Carolina brought arrests and convictions, and the Klan was forced to retreat. In the North, the Klan suffered another reversal when some local Klan chapters began to develop ties with American Nazis, a move Southern Klansmen opposed, but were generally powerless to stop. The end came in 1944, when the Internal Revenue Service filed a lien against the Ku Klux Klan for back taxes of more than $685,000 in profits earned during the 1920s.
We had to sell our assets and hand over the proceeds to the government and go out of business. Maybe the government can make something out of the Klan. I never could.
Colescott recalled when it was all over. Powerful social forces were at work in the United States following the Second World War. A new wave of immigrants, particularly Jewish refugees, arrived from war-torn Europe. A generation of young black soldiers returned home after having seen a part of a great army fighting for world freedom. In the South particularly, labor unions began extensive campaigns to organize poorly paid workers. The migration from the farms to the cities continued, with a resulting shakeup in old political alliances. Bigots began to howl louder than they had in many years, and a new Klan leader began to beat the drums of anti-black, anti-union, anti-Jew, anti-Catholic, and anti-communist hatred. This man was Samuel Green, an Atlanta doctor. Green managed to reorganize the Klan in California, Kentucky, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Georgia, South Carolina, Tennessee, Florida, and Alabama. But both federal and state bureaus of investigation prosecuted Klan lawlessness, and Green found out that his hooded order was surrounded by enemies. The press throughout the South had become increasingly hostile. Ministers were more and more inclined to attack the Klan, and state and local governments passed laws against cross-burnings and masks. By the time of Green's death in August 1949, the Klan was fractured internally by disputes and hounded by investigations from all sides in response to a wave of Klan violence in the South. Many Klansmen went to jail for floggings or other criminal acts, and by the early 1950s, the Invisible Empire was at its lowest level since its rebirth on Stone Mountain in 1915. A study into the ebb and flow of the Ku Klux Klan in the United States revealed a pattern that the Klan is strong when its leaders are able to capitalize on social tensions and the fears of white people. As its popularity escalates and its fanaticism leads to violence, there is greater scrutiny by law enforcement, the press, and government. The Klan loses whatever public acceptance it had, and disputes within the ranks finally destroy its effectiveness as a terrorist organization. The civil rights era Klan conforms to that pattern. When the Supreme Court threw out the separate but equal creed and ordered school integration in 1954, many whites throughout the South were determined to oppose the law and maintain segregation. Like the Southern opposition to Reconstruction government, the tensions and fears that arose after the Supreme Court decision provided the groundwork for a Klan resurgence. In 1953, automobile plant worker Eldon Edwards formed the U.S. Klans, also known as the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. This was formed in Atlanta, but he attracted few members until the Supreme Court decision the following year. By September 1956, Edwards was host to one of the largest Klan rallies in years, drawing 3,000 members to Stone Mountain, the site of the rebirth of the Klan in 1915. And by 1958, Edwards' group had an estimated 12,000 to 15,000 members. The US Klans wasn't the only Klan organization trying to gain a stronghold in the South, however. A number of rival factions made a name for themselves through gruesome acts of violence. A US Klan splinter group in Alabama was responsible for the 1957 assault on Edward Judge Aaron, a black handyman from Birmingham. Members abducted him, castrated him, and poured hot turpentine into his wounds. Edwards died in 1960, and the U.S. Klan's organization fell into disarray. The next year, Robert M. Shelton, an Alabama salesman, formed the United Klans of America. Shelton achieved national notoriety when his Klansmen viciously beat black and white freedom riders in Birmingham, Montgomery, and Anniston, and joined in violent confrontations on university campuses in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. By 1964, Shelton had a loosely organized Klan empire throughout the South. And by 1965, total Klan membership had reached an estimated 35,000 to 50,000 members. Then came the Klan killings. The South in the early 1960s was the site of daily tensions between those who favored integration and those who opposed it, and the tension sometimes led to bloodshed. Civil rights marches were attacked in Birmingham by police with dogs and fire hoses, freedom riders, blacks and whites who rode buses throughout the South to protest racial inequalities were mobbed by Klansmen in planned attacks. Civil rights leaders had their homes burned and their churches bombed. Klan members were involved in much of the racial violence that spread throughout the Deep South, and the fanatic Klan rhetoric inspired non-Klan members to participate in the campaign of terror and hatred. No Klan group was more ruthless than the secretive White Knights of Mississippi. The White Knights had only 6,000 or 7,000 members at its peak, but it still earned a reputation as the most bloodthirsty faction of the Klan since the Reconstruction era. The White Knights committed many crimes during the 1960s, but the most shocking were the murders of one black and two white civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi, on June 21, 1964. There were other senseless Klan killings during the 1960s. Among the victims were Lieutenant Colonel Lamar Penn, a black educator who was shot as he was returning to his home in Washington after summer military duty at Fort Benning, Georgia. Reverend James Reeb, who was beaten during voting rights protests in Selma, Alabama, and Viola Liezo, a civil rights worker who was shot in 1965 while driving between Montgomery and Selma. The use of bombs by Klansmen dated back to January 1956, when the home of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Montgomery was blasted. Between that incident and June 1, 1963, some 138 bombings were reported, and the Klan was believed responsible for many of them. One bombing stands out in the history of the Klan and its fanatical fight against integration in the South. On September 15, 1963, a dynamite bomb ripped apart the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, killing four young black girls. Of all of the crimes committed by all of the desperate men under the sway of the Klan's twisted preaching, the Birmingham church bombing remains in a category all by itself. All told, the Klan's campaign of terror against the civil rights movement resulted in almost 70 bombings in Georgia and Alabama, the arson of 30 black churches in Mississippi, and 10 racial killings in Alabama alone. Members of the Ku Klux Klan were often operating in an atmosphere of official disapproval, but unofficial acceptance, in regards to their tactics. While Southern law enforcement authorities made perfunctory efforts to arrest and prosecute the bombers, politicians pledged resistance to integration, and communities responded by closing ranks against black people. The acts of violence finally began to arouse public indignation in the South and across the nation. In 1964, a silent counterattack was begun by the FBI, which made a major effort to infiltrate the Klan. And by September 1965, the FBI had informants at the top level of 7 of the 14 different Klans that were in existence. Of the estimated 10,000 active Klan members, some 2,000 were relaying information to the government. Although the FBI arrested Klansmen and prevented some violence because of this information, critics accused the Bureau of improperly controlling some informers who may have been involved in illegal acts themselves. In 1965, Klan violence prompted President Lyndon B. Johnson and Georgia Congressman Charles L. Weltner to call for a congressional probe of the KKK. The resulting investigation produced a parade of tight-lipped Klansmen, evasive answers, and tales of violence, as had similar probes in 1871 and 1921. This time, however, the House of Representatives voted to cite 7 Klan leaders, including Shelton, for contempt of Congress for refusing to turn over Klan records. The 7 Klansmen were indicted by a federal grand jury and found guilty in a Washington trial. Shelton and 2 other Klan leaders spent a year in prison following this. Pressure from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the congressional probe, and Southerners' wariness of violence took its toll on the Klan. Shelton and other Klan leaders still raged at black people, Jews, and other imagined enemies of the nation, but increasingly their public activities were confined to rallies and speeches, while they privately tried to hold together their fractured empire. Some of their members would drift and form a new white mob, led by Klansmen, and they burned a freedom bus in Anniston, Alabama. Some were convicted like Shelton and sent to prison. Some remained active, but seemed less eager for clashing with authorities. The stalwarts of the Klan kept hammering away at the old themes of hatred. Though calls for violence were now muted, their fanaticism was undimmed. Instinctively, they seemed to know their fight would carry on into the 1970s and beyond, fueled by the vulnerability of some Americans to the cry of racial prejudice that brought the Klan to life 3 times in the century following the Civil War. During the late 1970s, it looked as if the Klan was heading for a revival to match its 3rd incarnation during the civil rights struggle. Between 1975 and 1979, Klan membership jumped from 6,500 to 10,000, to an estimated 75,000 active sympathizers who read Klan literature or attended rallies but weren't card-carrying members. Much of the Klan's gain was due to an improved public image fashioned by David Duke. A former neo-Nazi, Duke formed the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in 1975 and traveled the country soliciting radio and television appearances. Duke was articulate, well-dressed, and willing to conceal his extreme racism for the general public. Soon, journalists everywhere began writing about the new Klan. Many of the recruits to the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan were people who wrote to Duke after seeing him on television. Clan groups that had been inactive for years also saw their membership growing again. Duke and others tried to translate the newfound attention into political power, with some surprising results but little real success. Duke ran for the Louisiana Senate in 1975 and received a third of the vote. In 1980, California Klan leader Tom Metzger won the Democratic nomination for a seat in the U.S. Congress, but lost the general election. Defeated for the state Senate again in 1979, Duke lost his hold on the Knights when a rival Klan leader accused him of offering to sell his membership list. Don Black, who replaced Duke in 1980, tried unsuccessfully to sustain the image of the Klan respectability. Black had been in charge of the Knights for only a year when he was arrested with other Klansmen and neo-Nazis for attempting to overthrow the government of the Dominican Republic. By this time, there was another Klan leader receiving national attention, not for his apparent moderation, but for his brazen militancy. Invisible Empire, Imperial Wizard Bill Wilkinson liked to appear in newspaper photos with a sneer on his face and two bodyguards by his side, each holding up submachine guns for the camera. He boasted about the weapons his Invisible Empire members typically brought to rallies. "These guns ain't for killing rabbits, they're for wasting people," Wilkinson said. Wilkinson followed Duke's lead in recruiting youth to the Klan, but he took the indoctrination a step further by setting up a Klan camp in Alabama where kids could learn weapons training along with racist ideology. The children learned early on the art of intimidation, and in one 1979 incident, about a dozen teenagers who were wearing Invisible Empire t-shirts burned an old school bus while assembled Klan members cheered. Wilkinson's Invisible Empire deliberately sought confrontation. The most notable was a campaign of harassment against black people in the town of Decatur, Alabama. In 1978, a 26-year-old, mentally challenged black man named Tommy Lee Hines was convicted of raping three white women. Black people in the community launched several protests, arguing that Hines lacked the mental capacity to plan the rapes. Sensing that racial tensions were ripe for an explosion, Wilkinson took his Klan members into the area and held a series of rallies that drew between 3,000 to 10,000 participants. In May 1979, 80 Invisible Empire members, armed with pistols, shotguns and clubs, confronted a Free Tommy Lee Hines parade in downtown Decatur. Two black men and two Klansmen were shot in the ensuing battle. 10 Invisible Empire members, including Wilkinson's Alabama Grand Dragon, were indicted in civil rights violations. Hines' conviction was later overturned on appeal, and he was declared mentally incompetent to stand trial. Louis Beam, a Grand Dragon under David Duke, was developing his own confrontational style down in Texas. Beam, a Vietnam veteran, instructed his Texas Knights in guerrilla warfare during the late 1970s and formed a paramilitary arm of the Knights called the Texas Emergency Reserve. When tensions developed between American and Vietnamese fishermen in Galveston Bay, Beam offered paramilitary training to the American fishermen. After burning a Vietnamese boat and issuing threats against the refugee fishermen, the Texas Knights were sued and subsequently ordered to end the harassment and the paramilitary training. In 1979, a group of Klansmen and Nazis planned a confrontation with members of the Communist Workers' Party, who were demonstrating against the Klan in Greensboro, North Carolina. The joint Klan and Nazi contingent arrived at the protest site, brought out their weapons and opened fire on the protesters, killing five people. They were acquitted of criminal charges but later found civilly liable for the killings. While they were on trial, another group of Klan and Nazi members were arrested for plotting to bomb parts of Greensboro if their friends were found guilty. Members of that group were convicted and sentenced to prison. Whilst the Klan organization was experiencing a surge in membership at this time, there was also a heightened public attention to another growing white supremacist faction within America, the neo-Nazis. These were white Americans who, like the Klan, believed in the superiority of the white race, but dressed in military-like uniforms instead of robes. They revered Adolf Hitler as their hero. Like the Klan, the neo-Nazis were small in numbers and highly fragmented. The two groups pursued similar, if somewhat paradoxical, courses during this period, striving for mainstream respectability and acceptance, while at the same time practicing confrontational tactics. Politics was the arena where the Nazis hoped to establish a broad following. In 1975, three National Socialist Party of America members made surprisingly strong but ultimately unsuccessful showings in their campaigns for city aldermen in Chicago. In 1976, a National Socialist White People's Party member whose campaign ads featured a swastika won almost 5,000 votes in his race for mayor of Milwaukee. The most astounding election results came in 1980, when NSPA leader Harold Covington drew 56,000 votes for his losing bid for Attorney General of North Carolina. The same year, Nazi Gerald R. Carlson won the Republican nomination for a Michigan congressional seat. Although Carlson was defeated in the general election, he polled 32% of the vote. At the same time they were running for office, Nazis were seeking confrontation. The most infamous was a riot which began by 200 rock-throwing youths and NSPA members in Chicago's Marquette Park in 1976. The youths had gathered to counter a black protest against inadequate public housing, and when the protesters failed to show up, they attacked the police and passing motorists with rocks and bottles. An off-duty police officer was shot and at least 200 cars were damaged. The next summer, NSPA members led another group of 1,500 angry white men to confront black demonstrators in Marquette Park. A riot erupted and 16 police officers were injured. The Chicago rallies followed an aborted attempt by the NSPA to march in Skokie, Illinois, a predominantly Jewish suburb. When the town tried to prevent the march, NSPA leader Frank Collin sued, and the case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which upheld the lower court's ruling that the Nazis must be allowed to march. The march was abandoned after Collin received permission to use a Chicago park, but the NSPA had already gained enormous publicity from the lawsuit. By the late 1970s and early 1980s, Klansmen and Nazis were beginning to see the value of cooperating with each other. Although they had roots in different traditions, the Klan in the post-Civil War South and the neo-Nazis in Hitler's Germany, they shared the same enemies and the same fanatic obsession with white supremacy. Some Klan leaders, like David Duke and Don Black, actually started out as Nazis. Former Nazi Glenn Miller incorporated the military fatigue uniform and the Nazi salute into his Klan organization in North Carolina. Edward Fields, in Georgia, brought both Klansmen and Nazis into the National States Rights Party. His virulently anti-Semitic publication, The Thunderbolt, which was later renamed The Truth at Last, was read by both groups. The combination of the Klan, with its historical foothold in American society, and the Nazis with a modern militancy that appealed to many younger ideologists, resulted in a racist front whose potential for danger was evident by the early 1980s. The Nazi influence radicalized traditional Klansmen. In secret camps all across the United States, white supremacists of all descriptions began training in the use of assault weapons, grenades, rocket launchers, and explosives, all in preparation for what they believed would be a nationwide race war. In 1981, more than 1,000 people learned advanced guerrilla warfare techniques at an annual paramilitary training camp sponsored by the Christian Patriots Defense League in Louisville, Illinois, which had ties to the white supremacist pseudo-religion Christian Identity. In 1982, at a Posse Comitatus survival school, members received instruction in the demolition of roadways, dams, and bridges. At the Covenant Sword and Arm of the Lord's Survivalist Compound, members stockpiled weapons and explosives and trained in urban warfare, martial arts, and wilderness survival in preparation for the coming war. An FBI raid on the compound in 1985 yielded hundreds of weapons and bombs and enough cyanide to poison the water supply of an entire city. Aggressive law enforcement and new legislation in many states halted much of the paramilitary training in the early 1980s, but white supremacists continued to advocate arms training and preparation for a race war. In the span of a decade, the white supremacist movement had expanded in so many directions that it no longer made sense to talk about the Ku Klux Klan alone. In addition to Nazis, there were survivalists, identity churches, and posse comitatus factions, the most diverse collection of white supremacist groups the United States has ever seen. These dangerous allies would evolve into the new hate movement of the 1980s and 90s. By the late 1980s, the Klan was once again in decline. The resurgence of a decade earlier had fizzled, and the Klan was down to around 5,000 members, much smaller than during the civil rights era, and a mere fraction of its size during its heyday of the 1920s. The ebb in Klan fortunes continued into the 1990s, and observers of the Invisible Empire began to question whether the organization would play any significant role in the extremist movements of the 21st century. A number of lawsuits against various factions contributed to the Klan's demise. The fear of litigation made Klan groups weary of organizing into chapters, naming officers, and expanding across state lines. The Klan also reeled under the weight of internal squabbles over money and power. The Klan had always been rife with petty infighting and jealousy among its leaders, and its natural inclination toward discord was exacerbated during the lean years of the 1980s and 1990s. Further dividing the movement was a disagreement over tactics. Some factions favored a cleaned-up organization that emphasized public relations, while rivals sought to revive the more militant tactics of earlier Klan incarnations. But it was the competition from other extremist groups that was the real drag on Klan membership and influence. Racism and bigotry still existed in the United States in the latter part of the 20th century, of course. The Klan just no longer seemed a relevant vehicle for expressing it. Meanwhile, the nation's reinvigorated neo-Nazi organizations filled that void, outpacing the Klan in sheer numbers, influence, and militant activism. In the 1990s, many extremists who once would have gravitated toward the Klan joined the anti-government Patriot movement, especially its militia wing. The philosophy of the Patriot movement, as well as its commitment to armed paramilitary training, had more appeal than the worn-out rhetoric of the Civil War Ku Klux Klan. But if the Klan's numbers were dropping, its terrorist philosophy was still influencing the extremist movement. Many of the leaders of the neo-Nazi and Patriot organizations started in the Klan and continued to espouse the Hooded Order's racist ideology in their new roles. This legacy of hate was a testament to the power of the Klan and its enduring influence for over a century. Also by the 1990s, evidence suggests that Klan leaders began to fear the legal consequences of their members' acts. Klan outfits toned down their rhetoric and propaganda, altered their recruiting tactics, and banned weapons, alcohol, and drugs from their rallies and meetings. In 1987, an all-white Mobile, Alabama jury awarded a $7 million judgment against the United Klans of America for the lynching of a young black man named Michael Donald. To satisfy the terms of the judgment, the group turned its headquarters over to the victim's mother and went out of business. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which filed a suit on behalf of Mrs. Donald, used this legal strategy against other Klan groups with an equally sordid history of violence. Over the years, the members of the Invisible Empire, Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, had been convicted of crimes ranging from cross burnings and bombings to assaults and murder. At its peak, it was the nation's largest Klan organization, operating in at least 20 states from coast to coast. A 1987 attack by the Invisible Empire on a peaceful civil rights march in an all-white Forsyth County, Georgia, proved to be the organization's undoing. SPLC filed suit, and in 1988 a federal jury ordered the Invisible Empire, the Southern White Knights, another participant in the violence, and 11 individual Klansmen to pay the marchers nearly $1 million in damages. In the settlement, the Invisible Empire's leader, James Farrens, agreed to relinquish all the group's assets, including its name, and personally pay $37,500 to the civil rights marchers. And by the summer of 1993, the Invisible Empire was defunct as a consequence of settling the lawsuit. In 1996, SPLC filed a civil action against the North Carolina-based Christian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan and four of its members on behalf of a black church in South Carolina that had been destroyed by arson the previous year. The century-old Macedonia Baptist Church, located near Bloomville, South Carolina, burnt to the ground on June 21, 1995, the night after another black church, the Mount Zion African Methodist Episcopal Church in nearby Greeleyville, was destroyed by fire. The arsons were among a string of over 30 suspicious fires at black or predominantly black churches between 1995 to 1996. The complaint, which asked for punitive and compensatory damages, contended that the Christian Knights encouraged their members to commit acts of violence and intimidation against blacks in order to promote the organization's goals and ideals. Whilst lawsuits have a proven history of disrupting and even disbanding white supremacist organizations, they also deliver a powerful warning to others within the movement. Hate violence can be expensive. A series of internal disagreements over leadership and tactics further decimated the Klan in the closing decades of the 20th century. Klan groups historically were rife with infighting and jealousy, but strong figures usually emerged to bridge the chasms and provide direction. No such individual appeared to reverse the group's failing fortunes, however. When the Invisible Empire crumbled in 1993, Tom Robb's Arkansas-based Knights of the Ku Klux Klan became the country's largest Klan organization by default. In the early 1990s, Robb won invaluable publicity by appearing on nationwide television talk shows and in a Time magazine article on the hate movement. Aside from Duke, no modern Klan leader was more adept at exploiting television than Robb. The television appearances helped him gain a national following, but they also earned him the scorn of militants in the white supremacist movement who despised the all-talk-and-no-action posture of Robb's organization. Robb's public relations campaign produced only short-lived gains for his organization. In time, Robb's television act suffered from overexposure and lost much of its novelty and shock appeal. The schism gave birth to a militant offshoot with strong neo-Nazi leanings called the Federation of Klans, Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. The leader of the group was Robb's former Illinois Grand Dragon, Ed Novak, who at one time had been affiliated with the National Socialist Party of America and the American Nazi Party. The Federation of Klans took more than a third of Robb's membership nationwide, including leaders and members from Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, California, Missouri, and Texas. Most of the defectors to Novak's group were hardcore militants who chafed under Robb's purposefully moderate non-violent policies and his timid racism. Novak said his group would be more militant than the Knights and would avoid the limelight Robb so avidly sought. After the split, Novak operated quietly behind the scenes, organizing rallies on private property and recruiting. But the militant Klan umbrella organization Novak hoped the Federation would become never quite materialized. The Knights went through another upheaval in 1994 when a renegade group took what remained of Robb's Midwest stronghold. The new group's leader, Michigan Klansman David Newman, appointed himself Imperial Wizard. Despite a threatening letter from Robb's lawyer, he vowed to continue to use the Knights' name. Newman's group tried to oust Robb as national director and claimed that they controlled the Knights. Robb dismissed the new faction as a mere blip on the radar screen, but the two massive defections in less than 1 year delivered a devastating blow to his organization. As Klan influence faded in the 1980s and 1990s, the white supremacist movement began to chart a new course. The Order, a terrorist group that committed murder, armed robbery, and counterfeiting in the early 1980s, became the new standard for bold action on behalf of white supremacy. The members of the Order were seen as people of action and consequence, fighting to the death, in the words of its leader, Bob Matthews. They fought for blood, soil, and honor. Matthews had lived the ideal, dying after a shootout with federal agents in 1984. The Klan, in contrast, looked plodding, cowardly, even foolish. The old line tradition Klan had come to be viewed as an outdated and out of touch, all talk and no action group. Militants left the Ku Klux Klan in droves, and as the Klan faltered, neo-Nazi organizations like the Aryan Nation and the National Alliance, as well as other white supremacist factions like the Church of the Creator and Tom Metzger's White Aryan Resistance, rose to prominence during the 1980s and 1990s. Where the KKK had failed in recruiting and keeping members, the neo-Nazi groups and other racist organizations succeeded spectacularly by focusing on the one thing that was vital to the hate movement's long-term survival: enlisting the next generation. To that end, they aggressively pursued the young, ruthless neo-Nazi skinheads and recruited heavily on high school and college campuses. Eager to prove their courage as radical racists, skinheads quickly became the most violent of all white supremacists. Prominent white supremacists also sought to manipulate and exploit the anti-government fervor of the militias that sprang up across the nation and became the most visible of the extremist organizations in the 1990s. By early 1997, the Southern Poverty Law Center's Clan Watch Project and its militia task force had identified 380 militias and 478 patriot support groups. Some 101 of these groups had ties to racist groups or leaders, or had expressed racist or anti-Semitic beliefs, and whilst camouflage fatigues may have replaced the Klan's robes, hatred of Jews, blacks, immigrants, and other minorities continued to infect the American cultural psyche. As the end of the century neared, there was no single monolithic Klan, if indeed there ever was one. The organization was in tatters, its decreasing membership scattered in scores of squabbling factions across the country, some with no more than a handful of adherents. The once powerful invisible empire was gone. Its successor, as the nation's largest clan group, the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, was fractured and disorganized. The most militant activists, such as Louis Beam, Robert Miles, and Tom Metzger, left the Klan years before and assumed leadership roles in other white supremacist groups. Since its birth in the aftermath of the Civil War, the Klan experienced three periods of significant strength in American history: the Reconstruction era of the 19th century, when the newly freed slaves began to hold office and own land; the 1920s, when the country's fierce anti-immigrant mood drove Klan membership into the millions; and finally, at the height of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, when blacks and other minorities began to demand equal treatment under the law. These periods of growth have one common characteristic. They were eras of great social upheaval when the dominant white population felt threatened. In each of these eras, as the perceived attack receded, the Klan faded with it. And yet, it has never completely disappeared. Will the Ku Klux Klan rebound again as a new century begins? And will it ever vanish completely? History would suggest a continued role for the Klan. For over a century, the Klan has always appeared on the stage whenever white Americans have felt threatened by people different from themselves. Even in decline and disarray, the Klan's message of hatred endures, supported by a record of violence and terror unmatched in the history of American extremist groups. And now, at a time when right-wing politics is on the rise in the United States once again, do you think we have seen the end of this hate-filled organization? Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.